I'm Warren Smith, and I'd like to welcome you to this standalone special episode of Listening In. Today, you'll be listening in on my conversation with actor, writer, and producer, Max McLean.
It made me nervous because I didn't have film experience. You know, I had stage experience. And I knew that I had to make the adjustment one-to-one. I remember my first day of shooting, I was really nervous because I just said, am I doing it right? I don't know what I'm doing. But by the second day, I said, okay, I think I can do this.
Millions of people around the world hear Max McLean every day. He's the unmistakable voice of several popular audio versions of the Bible, including the English Standard Version, the New International Version, and the King James Version. He also has a large, growing, and admiring audience for his adaptations of the works of C.S. Lewis for the stage. These adaptations include The Screwtape Letters, The Great Divorce, and Surprised by Joy. In fact, his stage version of Surprised by Joy was recently adapted into a film. The film is called The Most Reluctant Convert, the untold story of C.S. Lewis. Max McLean portrays the older Lewis, and it was released in 2021. It received rave reviews from both Christian and secular movie reviewers. Max McLean is a man of many parts, as you can see, and in addition to his work on the stage and the screen now, he's the founder of the Fellowship for Performing Arts, a New York City-based company that produces live theater and film from a Christian worldview perspective. In fact, Max McLean had this conversation with me from his office in New York via Zoom. Well, Max McLean, welcome to the program. It's a real honor to chat with you. I've been looking forward to this for a good long time. And I do want to talk about your movie, The Reluctant Convert, The Most Reluctant Convert, I should get it right. But I want to back up, if we could, maybe kind of to the beginning and just talk a little about the arc of your life. I mean, you were born in Panama. You came to the United States when you were 4 years old. I know your dad had a military career. Can you sort of fill in some gaps there? What was going on in that era of your life?
Yeah, well, my father's stepfather, he met my mom in Panama and married her and brought us. I was 4 years old, brought us to America, didn't speak any English. He was a very young GI. Mom was a ticket taker at a movie theater. I think they met at a movie theater. And we came into New York Harbor, Statue of Liberty, at the West Side Passenger Terminal on 48th Street, which is about 10 minutes from where I lived for 15 years.
Wow.
So that was kind of ironic. And then we traveled. But the first thing I had to do was learn and master the English language. Been working on that ever since. And we went to 10 different, I remember going to, dad made a career in the military. I went to different 10 different schools in between first grade and 12th grade. And, you know, when you're in that kind of world, you got to make your mark. And so I made it mostly in sports, football and basketball and track, did well in those. And I think that may have had some bearing in going to the theater in college. I didn't do any theater until I got into college, but that's how the theater bug bit.
Well, and you went to the University of Texas, and my understanding is that you, at least in part, got into theater because you were shy. You had stage fright, and you were wanting to use the theater arts to help you overcome that fear. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It was an upper-level constitutional history class taught sort of Socratically that it was like 10 people in the class, and I just really was a wallflower. He didn't hear my voice till the last, sort of towards the end of the semester. And one time he called on me, and I just froze, turned red and blue, and had sociophobia. So I thought I'd go to the weird part of campus and take an oral interpretation class. And that's how the bug bit. Yeah, that's right.
Well, so you end up graduating from the University of Texas. And is it at this point that you decide that you are going to make a career as an actor or in drama? Or did that come earlier. By the time you graduated, did you already know that that was the direction that you were moving?
Well, I knew I was going to pursue it. I'm not sure I was clear-minded enough to think that I would succeed, but I said, okay, I do want to pursue this and see where it goes. And then what was interesting, about a year later, I came to Christ. And that was really interesting, because I think that was where the germ of fellowship began, because I love story, and theater is storytelling. And an actor's job is to use one's voice, body, and mind to illuminate great ideas, great literature, great thoughts. And then all of a sudden I was confronted with the gospel, and really a thought immediately emerges: how do these two fit? How do they come together? And so that was an idea that came very early on. I didn't know what would come of it, but I just felt like it would. And I was in England, and sort of English Christians are a little bit different than American Christians. And I think it's because there's such a minority there. That, you know, the idea of your faith, working out your faith in fear and trembling, it seems to be more of a thing. When I came back to America, you know, Christianity felt like you were joining a country club.
Sure.
So yeah. It was a different kind of thing. Obviously there's some very serious Christians, but there was also this real cultural aspect to it. And the idea that I had for fellowship, just, it didn't register with a lot of people. But it registered with a few people, and slowly they sort of said, okay, Max, we'll see where this goes. And that's how fellowship began. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to pause at this stage, Max, because you've already introduced three or four, I think, important events that I want to unpack just a bit. One is coming to Christ. You said you came to Christ about that time, 1976. I've done a little bit of reading, and I want you to either debunk what I read. You know, you can't believe everything you read on the internet, right? And or confirm. My understanding is that you were raised in kind of a nominal Catholic home, and that it was your now wife, yeah, who really introduced you to faith. Is that accurate?
Yeah. When I say nominally Catholic, I probably should clarify that, because I do remember as a young boy, the Mass and the Gospel had an impact. And I remember catechism classes being really inspiring in a kind of strange way. Not a strange way, in the way it's intended to be. But I did notice that, you know, once you were confirmed, you were kind of on your own, right? And so you there was no structure, and I didn't ask for structure. So I really kind of went far afield and didn't even really notice it. But, you know, and then all of a sudden the church had no bearing. And then I did have, in my freshman year of college, I did have a religious experience that was very frightening. And I felt like it was God calling me, and I just was running away. You know, Lewis talks about, amiable agnostics talk cheerfully about man's search for God. I says, might as well be talking about the mouse's search for the cat.
Right.
That's sort of how I felt, it was horrifying, because I recognized that I was a sinner, and I recognized that I'd have to change my life. But I also recognized in that early stage that it was true. I mean, at least it was compelling, but it was too dangerous. So I ran away. And then when I met my wife and she introduced me, you know, I remember I was going to be with her on Sundays. I'd have to go to church, and the church experience wasn't very compelling, except I remember the Lord's Prayer. That part of the liturgy was to recite the Lord's Prayer, and I knew the Lord's Prayer. So that kind of triggered that early childhood thing that was really powerful. And then one of her friends came up and said, found out my history. I had a background as a history major. And he said, you know, Jesus was a person in history, just like Lincoln, just like George Washington. Well, that was news to me, because for some reason, you know, in the intervening years, I Jesus became fairy tales. And so that little thought, Jesus was a person in history, triggered something in my brain that said, okay, you know, it actually, what it did, it awakened a part of my brain that had been dormant. Hmm. And that was a very watershed moment, because it got me to read the Bible. And then I read John's gospel in one sitting. I thought Jesus was going to come out of the pages. And I, you know, I had a born again experience. I was about 23.
Yeah. Well, you know, Max, I don't want to make too much of this, but hearing you tell your story and having recently seen the most reluctant convert, it's kind of easy to see some parallels between your life and C.S. Lewis's life. You know, you both became believers as a young adult. You both became believers out of a religious background that was, you know, nominal, or that you had rejected as an adolescent. So am I reading too much into this?
Well, there is a couple of differences. You know, he was Protestant, and the main reason you were Protestant is because you weren't Catholic. And in his case, it was extremely political. You know, your religious faith was a political statement. That wasn't the case for me. The other thing, too, is the gentleman you're comparing me to is 10 times smarter than I am.
Well, I appreciate that humility there. And I would say another thing about Lewis. I think it would be fair to say, and I would be curious about your perspective, because I know you've, you know, tried to get inside his mind and inside his heart deeply as a, you know, as someone who has portrayed him in a number of, in many different settings. Mm-hmm. But Lewis strikes me as a man who was deeply traumatized by the war, that he was in a very real sense suffering from what we might today call post-traumatic stress disorder. Do you agree with that?
I'm sure of that. Yeah, he had horrible nightmares. And in addition, it was kind of, you know, it was kind of the last of a trifecta, because, you know, he lost his mother to cancer when he was about 8. And then that completely destroyed all serenity in his life. He had a terrible relation with his father. And then, you know, he goes into the butchery of World War I, where, you know, he saw these wounded men looking like crushed beetles. And the idea of it is them kind of squirming, and that being so normative. And it was a normative experience. And he thought the irrationality of that, you know, that, you know, what a departure from normal, rational life. And this being so normative, that he came to the conclusion, either there's no God behind the universe, a God indifferent to good and evil, or worse, an evil God. And one of my favorite lines in the play, in the movie, is he tells her that, you know, he comes back to Oxford in 1919. He went to war in 1918 and was wounded after 5 months. And then, you know, after his recovery, he goes back to school. And when he goes back to school, the war's over. But he notices that at his particular college, it was University College, I think, hadn't had a regular meeting since 1914. And then they read the minutes of the last meeting that they had. And it awakened him to the fact that a whole generation of young men were lost. And he called it such a waste. And that, you know, that kind of redoubled his thought. And someone asked him, he says, were you much frightened in France? And he goes, all the time, but I never sank so low as to pray.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that really tells you where he came from. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to return to Lewis later, because your career is so much about Lewis, at least lately. But before we do that, I want to ask you a few questions. I want to stick to Max and not to Jack, if I could, just for a moment.
Sure.
And you become a believer around 1976. You get married about that time as well. I wasn't able to get some clarity about this, Max, in my online searches. Did you go to seminary as well?
I went to seminary a little bit later, but at that time I went to drama school, and when we were married, Sharon was teaching at the American School in London, and I was a student at drama school. And then when I came back to America a couple of years later, I think this was 76. I came back to America in late 70, like November 78, and got involved in a church. Realized that theater in New York was not what I was thinking. And to make a living, you'd have to do all these commercials. And I thought, and by that time, it was interesting. I, you know, my faith was really growing. You know, I realized you can't serve two masters. And I just sort of felt like, is this what I really want to do? Because it just, and I saw so many young actors. I was like 24 at the time. So many young actors just struggling, just compromising so much. I mean, and these are not even Christians. They're just trying to survive. And New York in the late 70s was just a brutal place.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was just not a good place. It's like it is now.
Yeah. Well, in fact, an interview that I read that you did a few years ago, Max, said that that era in your life, you said you found acting both demanding and unfulfilling because it was other people's words. And while an actor at some level, has to assume the role, you know, of course, whenever you're portraying Lewis, you're going to put Lewis's words in your mouth. You're not going to make up words for C.S. Lewis, so to speak. But still, you've got to believe them at some level, I'm guessing. Is that what you were struggling with?
Yeah, well, I felt that way. That's what I enjoyed because, you know, in drama school, you're dealing with Shakespeare, you're dealing with Shaw, you're dealing with Ibsen. Your brain is just synapsing all the time, just all, and then you come up and you just do schlock and stuff, and it's very demanding to get even that kind of work, you know, because there's 40 actors will take that job, you don't take it, and then you have to pound the pavements, you know, it's really a numbers game. I mean, there's to succeed in the theater, you need two kinds of talent. You need the talent to do the work, the acting, you know, the creative talent. And then you really need the perseverance and the discipline to go through the ropes of trying to get an agent, to do all those casting calls and do that, you know, because most of the jobs you get don't pay. If they pay anything, they pay very little. So you have to have two jobs. I was married. And then when my first child came in 1980, I says, I can't do this.
Yeah,
I can't do this. And what happened? So that felt like a failure. So then we were going to a really good church in New Jersey that had so many good things going for it. And it was such a healthy place. And I had never been to a place like that, you know, and I really grew. And that's when I decided to go to seminary.
Yeah.
I went to seminary for just a couple of semesters, but there were some people at that seminary that found out I had a theater background. They said, why don't you use your skills and techniques to do ministry? And that's kind of the beginning of the rest of my life.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I read an interview, Max, that you did where you quoted the great critic Harold Clurman, who said that part of the secret of the theater is that you can make people laugh, and while their mouths are open, you can pour in the truth. It strikes me that while not everything that you do is to make people laugh, what you do is you do make people sometimes go, aha, and open up their mouths, and you can kind of pour the truth in that way, right?
Well, yeah. That's the nature of entertainment in its most positive sense is you just allow people to relax and to receive without, you know, the idea of a lecture is either, you know, you're studying it to learn it or you're critiquing it, you know, you're challenging it. When theater's working, when entertainment's working, you're just allowing things to relax and receive. And that's one of the reasons I think theater is so important, you know, because it puts you in a different place. You go into a darkened room and you're with several hundred other people. And if it's working, then the whole event becomes like a single mind.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful experience that you rarely get other places.
So, Max, what was the pivot point for you when you know, you're a young man, you're acting, you're also trying to raise a family and nurture your Christian faith as well, and realizing that it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to sort of square all of that, family, career, and Christian faith. So at some point, you kind of take matters into your own hands. You decide, it seems to me, from looking at the outside at your career, that you said, if this is going to work, I'm going to have to make it work. I'm going to have to develop some entrepreneurial skills in addition to the acting skills to make this work financially. First of all, do I have that right? And secondly, if I do, what was the turning point? When did you come to that conclusion?
Well, there was a couple of turning points there. One was when I went to seminary, some of the faculty there, you know, sort of said, listen, we have a lot of people doing this kind of work, you know, pastoral work or missionary work. We don't have anybody doing what you're doing. So I think you should figure out a way to see how you can use your unique skills and talents and experiences. You know, one of my favorite verses is work out your salvation in fear and troubling, for his God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purposes. So it was a certain way of how do I work this out? You know, how do I work it out? And then it's God working in me. You know, both those two things are happening. And so how that manifests itself is I thought, well, why not use the skills and techniques developed in the theater and apply it to the Bible? And so I started memorizing Mark's gospel. And when I did it, the first time I did it, it was like an event waiting to happen. I mean, the response to it was so profound because nobody had ever seen it, you know, and people talk about the gospel, but they don't experience the gospel. And I think anytime you do this well, the Lord's going to really use it. And so what happened, this would have been in the early 80s, mid 80s. I was being invited to churches, and usually it was in the denomination I was in, it was Christian Missionary Alliance. And then there was this very famous pastor with the Presbyterian denomination that he saw me at a small church in Florida, and he said, young man, the Lord keeps you humble. He's going to use you. And then he proceeded to type out, I think he used a regular typewriter. This would have been 88, something like that, a little typewriter. And he typed out letters, like full page letters to D. James Kennedy, Frank Barker, R.C. Sproul, all his buddies in that group.
Yeah.
And next thing I know, I'm being invited to these places.
And is that how you made a living in that era? You were able to
just do free will offerings and that sort of thing. And then what? Then the second big shift. So one thing that happened, I was on the road like 150, 200 nights a year, and I hated that. That was just too much. It's just not a way to live. And then I started doing, I was contacting campus ministers, and I had some good success there, you know, people responding. And I remember one event I was doing, Will Willimon at Duke Chapel invited me to come. And in the audience was the director of the drama department at Duke. And he wrote me this incredible letter saying, you know, I was looking forward to this with all the pleasure of dental surgery. And then he turned around and said, what did I find? I saw a piece of material that I now for the first time, I realize why it's so compelling. And when that happened, I thought, if I didn't have to be on the road all this much, and if I could develop productions, you know, and do it in mainstream settings, I think that something significant could happen. And that was what the Lord did. And so that's how I started Fellowship back in 1992.
Well, you've referred to Fellowship a few times. Let's talk about that just for a minute. That's the Fellowship of Performing Arts. That is the organization that you lead. It's the organization that is really the centerpiece of not only your theatrical productions, but also the movie as well. So talk about, you know, that organization, how it came to be and how it has grown in recent years.
Right. Well, you know, I mentioned earlier about how few people got it. You know, what I was trying to do, you know, I had this vision of art and Christianity together. And I was in the CMA world, Christian Missionary Alliance world, which was really very missionary driven, and very few people got it. Now I went into the Presbyterian world a little bit and more people got it there. But anyway, what happened at the beginning was just a few people got around it enough that I could go on salary, didn't have to be on the road all the time. And I could begin to shape it. And what I ended up doing was starting to produce theatrical events and doing them in New York, doing them in Chicago, doing them in, you know, in the marketplace of theater, you know, not in churches. And then what would happen, church people would go to it and they would bring their friends and they would say, this is different. This is new. And it's interesting, a little bit more cutting edge. And, you know, in the late 90s, there was a book, you probably remember it, called Roaring Lambs. Do you remember that book?
Oh, you bet. Bob Reiner. Yeah. I had a correspondence with Bob Reiner in the last couple of years before he passed away. Yep.
That was kind of revolutionary because that sort of helped Chris. He was more in the music business and all that, but it's helped sort of crystallize. I says, okay, let me see if this could work. And you know, it began, and then I think shortly thereafter, we raised enough money to record the Bible. I've done five Bible recordings. I think more people know my voice than anything else.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Max, because that is how I probably know you best, is listening to you read the Bible. And I did want to ask just a quick question about that. This is kind of a silly question, but I can't resist asking anyway. How long does it take you to record the entire Bible?
Well, I've done it five different times. You know, the last one I did was the NIV 2011 version, the one that it did. I started that in April and finished it in August. By that time, I had a recording studio in my home, and so I could do it at my time. The Bible is about 80 hours of finished text, and I would say most of it I would go straight through, and then I'd have to do, you know, and I would have a listener listening to me while I record, and they would say stop, or if I say I didn't pronounce that right, or if I felt like I missed the meaning of it, then I'd go back. But most of the time, by that time, I'd been through the Bible many times, so I kind of had the flow of it. The biggest part of it is, you know, the editing. That's, I'm so grateful that's other people's work. But then what happens is after the, you know, you do your recording, you have your listener who tells you all to redo stuff. Then you send it to the editor. And then he comes back and says, well, you made a mistake here. You made a mistake here. You got to redo this, got to redo that. And that takes a long time. So that's the process. So, but for the last one, 4 months of the actual beginning, and then, you know, quite a bit after the fact, after the editing.
Yeah. Well, what a gift those readings are. I mean, not only is your reading of the Bible beautiful, but I know because I bear witness with my own life that those audio versions allow me to experience the Bible, listen to the Bible, you know, whenever I'm not able to read the Bible, which I know is at least part of your intention. And so God bless you for that. And thank you for that.
It certainly gives you a helicopter view. And that was my recollection of when I did Mark's Gospel early on. Because, you know, people see it in bits and pieces and they don't get the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah. So, Max, we're nearly 30 minutes into our conversation and we haven't even gotten to the most reluctant convert, really. So let me try to telescope some of this. You started doing C.S. Lewis kind of, you know, in a formal theatrical setting, at least my understanding is, with the Screwtape Letters. Do I have that right?
Yes, that was the first one.
And that was now, I guess, nearly 20 years ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think we got the rights somewhere around 2004, and we did our first development production in 05. So, yeah, about 18 years ago now. Yeah.
So walk me through this journey with C.S. Lewis. So, you know, from 2004 when you got the rights, then you start developing and then you start performing it and then you do The Great Divorce. And now most recently, The Most Reluctant Convert, which is based on Surprised by Joy, at least in part, mostly I would say. And so you've kind of grown up with Lewis. I mean, when you started doing this, you were probably 20 years younger than.
Well, I was still, let's see, I was probably around 40, late 40s anyway. Yeah. And I actually don't think I could have done them earlier. I don't think I would have had the skill set. What happened was a theater professor at Drew University saw one of our Bible presentations and he liked it. He wrote me an email. He says, I think you should. He said, I think you'd make a really good Screwtape. And I didn't know if that was a compliment or not. but it was what it really intrigued me, because I did have a very, very strong response to Screwtape in my 20s. It was one of the first Christian books I read after my conversion. And it really gave me an insight into spiritual warfare. But I never saw it as theatrical literature, you know. But he had an idea how to do it. And I said, well, if we can get the rights, we'll give it a go. We got the rights. And we did it. And we did about three different versions of it. The first one we did just wasn't very clear. And it wasn't really it was hard to follow. But by the time we kind of played with it for a couple of years, we finally got it to a place that the story was becoming more clear and people could get it. And I did it pretty regularly from probably 2007 to 2012. I did it a lot. And then I taught other actors how to do it. And I don't think I could go back to it. I don't think I have the, I think it's a young man's sport, that show.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did other shows, and I want to ask you kind of a technical question, Max, because your on stage performances are kind of a combination of acting and narrative, where you're actually talking to the audience. You sort of, you know, it, to use, I guess, theater language, you break the fourth wall.
Yeah,
pretty
that's
frequently
a key thing that I felt it's necessary because Lewis does it. And I mean, I've done shows without breaking the fourth wall, but the one person shows almost have to.
Right. Well, so talk more about that, because you do that not only in your theatrical productions, but you also do it in this new movie as well. In fact, I don't want to give too much. I won't give too much away, because it starts, the very beginning of the movie starts this way. You are intentionally, consciously on a movie set in, in the current time, and then you go back in time, and you don't come out of character until the very end, but you do break the fourth wall frequently. In fact, there are two C.S. Lewis's.
He offers the audience a drink. Yeah, that was Norman Stone's idea. I think what he wanted, when I gave him the script, he actually wrote the screenplay. You know, I wrote the stage play, and he wrote the screenplay, which is very close to stage play, but it has all of the, you know, the accoutrements. I mean, the stage play is one actor, one set. The film is 18 locations, 15 actors, three actors playing Lewis, 190 extras, 270 costumes. It's a, you know, bigger thing. And he filled it all out. And one of the things he wanted to do was say, well, how do I maintain the theatricality of it? And he came up with the idea, okay, let's find you in your dressing room. Let's have a script in your hand. Let's go into the soundstage. You know, you're nervous as you're about to begin, and you know, where's my phone? How's my hair? All that.
Right.
And then you start, and then you start in the film set, and then you go through a door and you're in Oxford. And in the rest of the show, you know, you have moments when you go back and forth. But then at the end of the play, you know, you come back to being an actor.
Yeah.
And that's pretty controversial. I mean, some people like it, some people don't. I could go either way. It wasn't my call. But one of the things Norman was concerned about was he didn't want the film to be too maudlin. He didn't want it to be too earnest. He feels Christian films are too earnest.
Yeah,
and so you know, he might go a little bit too much in that, trying to not do that, but that influenced him.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can understand what you said. I could go either way with it, but just count me among those people that really liked it. In fact, I especially liked that line at the beginning when you said, "Where's my phone?" I was like, I chuckled whenever that line came on. So one other quick thing about the film, sort of a technical matter, Max, and let's just stipulate for the record, you're a pro. You've been doing this a long time. I get all of that. But acting for the movies is very, very different than acting for the theater. And there are a lot of close-ups. I mean, you've got to be extraordinarily subtle in those, when, you know, when your face is 4 feet wide on a movie screen. Was that a hard adjustment for you?
It was, it made me nervous because, you know, the imprint of stage is the voice. The imprint of film is the image. And I didn't know if I was going to come across as too big because I didn't have film experience. I had stage experience, but I also did a lot of narration work. And one thing about narration work is one-to-one. And so I knew that I had to make the adjustment one-to-one. And in some ways, breaking the fourth wall really helped because I was playing to the camera. And many times I was looking directly at the lens.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I felt like, okay, I can do that. And then when that worked, I think the rest kind of fell into place. I remember my first day of shooting, I was really nervous because I just said, am I doing it right? I don't know what I'm doing. But by the second day, I said, okay, I think I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, count me as among those who think you pulled it off. I thought it was very well done. I thought it was very beautiful. I very much enjoyed the movie, which brings me, I think, to my final question. I reserve the right to come up with another one, depending upon your answer. But I guess my final question for you is, what's next? Because, you know, this movie is kind of a new thing for you know, the Fellowship of Performing Arts, and for you, are y'all going to be doing more movies? Are more movies in your future?
I think, you know, first of all, it was a pivot because of COVID. You know, it was either do movies or do nothing. And in the sense of do movies, do nothing, Norm and I have been in conversations about Most Reluctant Convert film, and we were only at the treatment stage, and we saw it as maybe 2 or 3 years down the road because I had a bunch of things I was doing, he was doing things. But when COVID hit, there was nothing else to do. And so we said, let's just focus on the script. Let's move this forward. And then what happened was the British government opened up filmmaking in August of 2020. And Norman said, you know, listen, if we can get the funding, if we can do this, I can get a really good cast. I can get a really good crew because nobody's working. And I said, all right, will you confirm that? Confirm all the locations. I'll go to my board, see if we can release some money for getting in the can. We'll talk about post-production and distribution later. And then we did it. And we shot. I had to quarantine for a couple of weeks. We shot. We got everybody together in September and October. And the moment we closed the shot, within a week of when we closed this film set, they shut down for COVID again.
Wow! Wow!
A lot of films were in midstream and had to stop. So and what happened was the success of that film. The film did far better than we anticipated. And so what we're doing now is Norm and I are writing drafts for two more films because we want to tell, I want to have a film trilogy that will go from two more films beginning, you know, Most Reluctant Convert ends with his conversion. And he says that was the end of one journey, the beginning of another. And so what we want to do is start at 1931. And we want to look at his relationship with Mrs. Moore, because that's come out, and we want to tackle that. We want to tackle, you know, the Inklings, his relationship with Warnie, you know, the alcoholism and all that, because he really had a hard life. You know, he was very successful, but he had a hard life.
Yeah.
And then I think the second film will probably end. Supposedly he goes to an Inklings meeting and he's the only one who shows up. Nobody's there. It's done. And it's kind of sad, you know, but it also begins the whole Narnia chapter. And then the third movie will revisit the Joy Davidman story because, you know, Abby Santa Maria's book has come out. And
yeah. Yeah. I love that book, by the way. I don't know if you enjoyed it, but I did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was pretty, I mean, she burst some balloons, didn't she?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. No question.
Yeah, she really did. But we want to kind of tackle that. We're going to tackle what was going on in her life with Douglas Gresham, not Douglas, Bill Gresham. Bill Gresham. Yeah. You know, he wrote that movie, Nightmare Alley. Do you know that?
No, I did not.
You know, the one that just came out with Cate Blanchett and Bradley Cooper.
I know the movie, but I did not know he wrote it. Wow.
He wrote the novel that became the movie. And that tells you a lot about him. But we want to tell that story. And then we're going to look at the day he died. You know, he died within an hour of when Kennedy was assassinated. So all of that. And I'm very, very excited. We're trying to get that film made. And we're looking at doing it in beginning the shooting in late summer and try to finish it by November.
Yeah.
At least the filming. Yeah.
You've been listening in on my conversation with Max McLean. You can find Max's movie, The Most Reluctant Convert, The Untold Story of C.S. Lewis, on various streaming platforms, including Apple TV and Google Play. Max is on tour this summer with C.S. Lewis on stage, Further Up and Further In. He's in Indianapolis, Indiana this weekend. In the months ahead, he'll be in Kansas City, Missouri, Washington, D.C., Grand Rapids, Michigan, and a handful of other cities. You can learn more at the Fellowship for the Performing Arts website. A couple of quick notes before we go. First, Max McLean is not the only actor, director, or producer I've interviewed on Listening In. In fact, I've done nearly 500 long-form interviews over the past 9 years for World News Group with all manner of writers, filmmakers, musicians, theologians, politicians, interesting people of all times. But specifically for you cinephiles, those interviews include one with Jim Caviezel, who played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ, and Randall Wallace, the writer of Braveheart, Heaven is for Real, and We Were Soldiers. To find these interviews and others, just go to the World News Group website. That's WNG.org, and use the search engine to explore. This special episode of Listening In is a production of World Radio. Today's producer is Tim Lamer. Johnny Franklin is our technical producer. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and you've been listening in.